Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Day of the Jackal is a fictional account of a plot to assassinate French President Charles de Gaulle. The book became an international bestseller and won an Edgar Allan Poe Award when it was published 40 years ago. Joining me for this month's Reader's Review of Frederick Forsyth's classic spy thriller, Peter Starr, Dean at the College of Arts and Sciences here at the American University, Nancy Youssef, Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers, and John Weissman, author of Kill Bin Laden and other military thrillers. We do invite you to join us as well, 800-433-8850. And good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Peter, I wonder if I could start with you to remind us of the historical event itself. At what point do facts leave off and fiction begins?
Well, the beginning of the novel, as you know, Diane, is very, very factual. It's drawn from a explicit assassination attempt on de Gaulle's life at Petit Clamart. And de Gaulle had suffered up to 20 assassination attempts. And he was a fearless man. We can get into this later about his fearlessness and the way in which he literally looked death in the face many times in his life. And it's remarkably moving to me, I think, the extent to which this man, who was a target, managed to survive and rise up over all of that danger.
He knew that because of his decision on Algeria and many other decisions, that there was a group that absolutely loathed him, that wanted him out of the way. But he proceeded despite all that. Then we have Frederick Forsyth coming along. And what does he do?
Frederick Forsyth takes this historical germ. And as a journalist who himself arrived at Petit Clamart, the site of the scene that opens the novel, Frederick Forsyth builds a story which is fundamentally fictional, which is technically accurate. And that is something that I think John Weissman's work reflects so beautifully. And it's one of the lineages that I see between Frederick Forsyth and John Weissman. Technically incredibly accurate. That draws us in as readers precisely because of the technical accuracy and creates a fiction that is fundamentally true. And I think the pleasure, one of the things, I'm a literature professor, I teach literature, I teach people to understand and appreciate literature. One of the things that's remarkable about this novel is how true it is.
Peter Starr, he's dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and professor of literature at the American University. Nancy Youssef, Forsyth writes a novel where we already know the ending.
That's right.
But does that in any way affect the suspense of the novel?
No, the magic of it is in how he writes the story. This is a story about the attempted assassination of de Gaulle. Of course, de Gaulle wasn't assassinated. He died 7 years later after the setting of this book, watching TV at home. And you know that going in within pages of the book. But it's the magic is in the writing and in the details. And I think we take it for granted now, but at the time that this book came out, the approach was really quite audacious, this idea of weaving details, not just depending on one's imagination to put together a mystery novel, but what the author does is take his experience as a journalist and tie in all the facts and the underworld that he'd come to learn and make a novel that is really essentially research. That he wrote this book in 35 days, but he researched it over a career as a journalist. And I think that's what makes it so riveting. For me as a writer and as a journalist, what I found most captivating was the way he wove details together to bring you in, so that the outcome was almost an afterthought as a reader, but it was really how you got there that drew you in.
And Nancy Youssef is the Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy newspaper. She is also a frequent guest on the International Friday News Roundup. Turning to you, John Weissman, I have heard so much praise for Kill Bin Laden. I wonder if what Frederick Forsyth did in any way influenced your thinking, your writing, in presenting your own novel.
Well, he has always been a template for me. He broke through the same way, for example, that Joseph Wambaugh broke through the police procedural with the New Centurions. This book, this novel, very, very different than John le Carré's 1964, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, another mold breaker, by the way, another seminal novel. But this novel, for me, has always been the template because it is a seamless fusion of journalism and fiction writing.
And voices.
And voices, absolutely. I mean, all of the voices in this novel are distinct and strong.
And authentic.
Very authentic.
So we go from this group, this tiny group that plans this assassination, that takes over the top floor of a hotel in order to think about how best to complete their rage against de Gaulle because he has freed Algeria. And they decide the conversations among them are fascinating.
They are. And they come with a I mean, the question that Nancy was addressing, how do you write a plot in which the reader knows what the result is? And there's a moment at which the Jackal's plot is blown through a series of sort of pillow talk, essentially. And there's a moment at which Rodin and comrades are saying, should we recall him? And there's, at that moment, they realize that they can't recall him, that they can't communicate with this killer who is ruthless and motivated by money and wants to retire on the proceeds of this one big hit. And I think some of the pleasure of the novel is the fact that they can't recall him. He's loose. He is going to do what he's going to do, and he's inexorable in that way. And it's stunning that they can, that Forsyth can pull that off.
Yeah.
It's called plotting.
Yes.
and you know, novels are to use the cliche, 99% perspiration and 1% yes. inspiration. And what this novel is indicative of is the plotting that goes into a great, great book. You set up conditions so that the readers are inexorably drawn from point to point to point. I mean, this is connecting the dots.
I also think it's an intersection of motives, because the men who are plotting the assassination, and this was something as a war correspondent that drew me, are angry essentially about the false promises that were told to them and what, why they went to war, why they lost comrades, and sort of want retribution for that. And the Jackals, and we should mention that throughout this book we never know who he is, even till the very end. Our main character, we don't even know his name. His motives are far, far different, and yet they collide until the point that Peter mentioned, until they've lost control. But I found it fascinating that the driving factors behind it, because one is ideological and one is very practical.
Mm-hmm. Forsyth talks about the OAS, this group of real fanatics who are angry, as you said, about decisions that de Gaulle has made in regard to Algeria. You know, today we'd either call them fanatics, maybe we'd call them terrorists, John.
Well, the French certainly thought of them as terrorists, and of course they raised money by robbing banks and jewelry stores. DST.
To finance the whole thing.
Indeed. The DST, the French internal, their equivalent of the FBI, but with a lot more juice behind them, referred to this in the late 1990s as gangs terrorism. And it was exactly what the GIA, the Armed Islamic Group, did to raise money. It is what the Taliban do to raise money. They organize. They go into crime. The Taliban is growing narcotics, selling narcotics. The fact that Foresight was able to look at all this stuff and put it together, and yet give these people who the French thought of as terrorists a real good motive. And indeed, it was a motive, because you had an entire class of Frenchmen who had lived in Algeria, who had lived in Morocco, whose entire lives were built around that, uprooted, moved, abandoned, they felt. And I remember listening at one point in my life to a conversation in Paris in 1962 with some of these pieds noirs, talking about how de Gaulle had abandoned them, and it was an amazing thing then to read the novel some 10 years later.
John Weissman is a military thriller writer. His most recent novel is Kill Bin Laden. The phones are open. I hope you'll join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I look forward to hearing from you. And we're talking about Frederick Forsyth's novel, The Day of the Jackal, written around, 1974,
something, 71.
And when asked whether the Jackal was based on a real person, Forsyth said, "I do not have the kind of imagination to spin a character out of the air. I met the Jackal, although he did not have the smoothness and style of my Jackal. He was simply a professional killer." What did you think of the professional killer as Forsyth outlined him, John?
Well, the character is wonderful because his background, obviously, has given him the ability to be a totally protean character. His tradecraft is impeccable, and one of the things I try and do in my own novels is get the tradecraft right. And what this chap does in terms of the creation of multiple identities and self-protection rings absolutely true. This guy is made of flesh and blood. Whether or not Forsyth actually met him or someone like him, obviously he met someone close enough so that you can use that putty and start to mold it.
He's attractive to women, Nancy.
He is, and it's one of the many tools he employs in his effort to escape, and yet he He's an enigma and a loner. I thought what was interesting about him is his evolution from this man of intrigue to a psychopath. And I think it happens the first time he murders somebody, because you're no longer curious about what drives him. We get these descriptions of him and his gray eyes and his blonde hair and his demeanor and the way he dresses. And so there's still a mystery about him. Who is he? And then all of a sudden you realize he's driven strictly by the money, and that he's a psychopath.
And even those who hire him, Rodin looks at his gray, steely eyes and realizes there is no expression.
And massively intimidating with those gray, steely eyes. One of the things that I find interesting about this particular character is Forsyth says in an interview to the BBC he was a despicable character, and that he's often a bit surprised the extent to which readers identify with the jackal. We are like to see in these kinds of stories, we see a hyper-competent, often a hyper-competent antagonist and a hyper-competent protagonist. But what's interesting about this novel is that Lebel doesn't seem to be up to the jackal.
Now, describe Lebel. Tell us who he is.
Lebel is modest. He's a little bit henpecked by his wife. He is not a genius. He's not Poirot. He's not one of these Agatha Christie detectives who sees the thing that no one else sees. He's not that. He's methodical. John mentioned a moment ago about plotting, that it's 99% hard work. Detective, the novel says it, detective work is 95% hard work. And one minor little bit of intuition at the end that solves the case. So here you have this absolutely brilliantly technically competent and protagonist full of foresight and anticipation, and you've got this at the same time against him, a detective that you don't think is up to speed.
Except, from the very first, you begin to see Lebel is made of steel.
Absolutely.
And he takes no guff from this large group of self-important they would be referred around the Pentagon today as perfumed princes, who make fun of him because, he's got maybe cigarette
sort
ash.
Sort of rumpled clothes.
And he's rumpled.
Yeah.
But as his boss says, the best detective in France would be Lebel. And Lebel also, immediately upon being challenged by the bullies.
Yep.
Smacks them down.
Stands up. Nancy, what have you got?
Well, I wanted to mark how we are introduced to the jackal and how we're introduced to Lebel. I just want to read a graph from each to get a sense of who these two are.
Good.
To Rodin's eye, this is referring to the jackal, he looked like a man who'd retained control of himself, but the eyes bothered him. He had seen the soft, moist eyes of a weakling, the dull, shuttered eyes of psychopaths, and the watchful eye of soldiers, the eyes of an Englishman who were open and stared back with frank candor. Except for the irises, which were of flecked gray, so they seemed smoky, like the hoar mist of a winter's morning. It took Rodin a few seconds to realize that they had no expression at all. Whatever thoughts did go behind the smoke screen, nothing came through, and Rodin felt a worn of unease. Like all men created by the systems and procedures, he did not like the unpredictable and therefore uncontrollable. And now let's get to on page. That was on page 40. And here we get introduced to our detective, Lebel. And notice the difference in the description. Claude Lebel, as we all knew, a good cop. He had always been a good cop, slow, precise, methodical, painstaking. Just occasionally he'd shown a flash of inspiration that is needed to turn a good cop into a remarkable detective. But he'd never lost sight of the fact that in police work, 99% of the effort is routine, unspectacular inquiry, checking and double-checking, laboriously building up a web of parts until the parts become whole, and the whole becomes the net, and the net finally encloses the criminal with a case that will not just make headlines, but stand up in court.
Absolutely. Perfect reading and understanding these two antagonists. The jackal. How does he get his name? What is his name?
Well, he gets his name because the first three letters of his first name and last name under the alias that he is currently using, which is Charles Calthrop, is C-H-A-C-A-L, which in French is jackal. But obviously he gets other passports under different names. And one of the best pieces of tradecraft here, actually, is how he gets a British passport, which in those days was very, very easy to do, by going and finding someone who is approximately the same age as you, who died as a youngster, and you get their birth certificate and their death certificate, and then you burn the death certificate, and you go to the registry office. And, of course, in those days, nothing was on a computer. They didn't have computers. And he forges a priest's signature and the church papers, and you present that. And in the mail, at a mail drop, you get a British passport.
And another element of his absolute brilliance is smuggling this handmade, precision-made gun in the chassis of the car that he drives across the border.
This is something that Forsythe does not in this novel alone, but also in the Fourth Protocol. He has a nuclear device smuggled by, I think it's 9 separate couriers from Russia, the Soviet Union, to London to be assembled by a technician next to an American airbase and blown up. The tradecraft, let me talk just a minute about the tradecraft in this book. Forsythe understands intelligence tradecraft and counterterrorism tradecraft. What the Jackal does is no different from what Al-Qaeda does. He is searching for vulnerabilities in his targets. Mm. When I teach counterterrorism, one of the things you first teach is you have to think like a bad guy. Bad guys will take the path of least resistance. And to teach this, to teach vulnerability, is to think like a terrorist. And so the Jackal says, okay, where am I most vulnerable at the crossing points? How do I get through the crossing points? How do I get through a police barrier? And what he does is he does what all good terrorists do. He sits back and he looks. And he looks at the patterns and he looks for anomalies. And, for example, he sets himself up near the old Gare Montparnasse and sits. And, by the way, if you check the maps of Paris and go on Google Earth, you will see that that street and those buildings are exactly as described, which is just wonderful.
And, of course, he manages again to disguise himself as an elderly man using a crutch, but he is not the only one figuring. LaBelle is there because LaBelle figures that day, that particular celebration, de Gaulle will be in public. And that is the opportunity he knows the Jackal is waiting for.
Because it's guaranteed that he'll be there. He has to be there. He knows where he can be, so he can pick his sniper spot. He can plot weeks in advance, which is what he does. And what's interesting is about LaBelle is he investigates until the very last second.
He sure does.
Even when the ceremonies go on and nothing's happened, and there's one more ceremony and it goes on and nothing happens. And it's by chance that someone mentions, I let this man with a cripple into his house, and he chases. And it's really within, the difference is a matter of seconds. He is that methodical person until the very, very last minute.
And had LaBelle gone through the door first, it would have been he who would have lost his life.
Absolutely.
But it's just fascinating. We've got lots of callers waiting. 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Elaine in Annapolis, Maryland. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Can you hear me okay?
I certainly can. Go right ahead.
All right. The main phrase, technically correct. My hat's off to the author, Mr. Forsyth. Briefly, some years back, I was asked to read this very novel and act upon it. I followed the British churchyard procedure, the birth certificate, and there is not now somebody running around the world with yet another passport. I don't want to keep the conversation too long before the FBI and all the squad cars arrive. I think, to the best of my knowledge, my cell phone is not traceable, but you never know. But if I can do this, so can lots of other people. Thank you very much, Chuck.
John.
Well, until very recently, you could do it. You can still do it. And Mr. Forsyth actually has complained about this too in the press. He's written a number of op-ed pieces. The tradecraft is still practiced, and it's not a good thing, especially since the Brits suffer from so much internal terrorism right now.
John Weissman. His most recent novel is Kill Bin Laden, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Nancy.
It's also worth pointing out that this book has been translated in a number of languages and has showed up in the homes of some assassins. The man who was involved in Yitzhak Rabin's assassination, Carlos the Jackal, named after this book. And so it's interesting in this effort to make this so realistic, it's actually become, for some people, a manual in terms of how to carry out these things because of the way he methodically paints it. Now, how much you can assign to anything to the book itself is unclear, but it certainly resonates with the underworld itself because of the rich detail in which he describes it.
Pete. And Forsyth himself, in a BBC interview a number of years ago, said that he put in some of his more technically nuclear-related plots, he intentionally put flaws in the technical details in order to preclude that from happening.
Fascinating.
It's what you actually have to do these days because, look, the bad guys can buy on Amazon the way the rest of us can.
Of course.
And so as a writer, I mean, I'm looking at stuff as I write it and saying, okay, is this safe to use? Is it not safe to use? Luckily, I've got a brain trust of people who have very, very, very high classifications, who will look at chunks of the manuscript and say, okay, you can get away with that, but we wish
stop
you would
there.
Actually just stop.
Yeah. Let's go to Chris, who's here in Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, for the benefit of some maybe younger listeners, the factual actualities of this fictional novel, I suppose, were quite novel. So can you explain how Algeria related to the French Republic and why so many people felt passionate in its loss and the colonists that had to leave? And why was that so passionate for, why was Algeria so important to France?
Peter.
France's sense of itself as a world power had been put into jeopardy first in 1870 with the Franco-Prussian War, then again in the long slog of the First World War, then again in the defeat in the beginning part of the Second War. And so Algeria was one of the last gasps of a French imperial presence in the world. And de Gaulle represented a resurgence and a reaffirmation of France. I mean, de Gaulle was France. He referred to himself in a third person. He referred to himself as France. So the Algerians, those who believed in what was called l'Algérie française, very strongly felt that he was going to support them going forward. Remember, a lot of the war efforts had been taken place in North Africa. So it was a very important part for de Gaulle's own work in the Free French. He said famously, I think it was first time back to Algeria after he was named president of the Fifth Republic in 58, he said, "Je vous ai compris, I've understood you." And they understood that to mean he supports them. So when de Gaulle, and for reasons that Forsyth himself talks about when he's introducing Rodin, he says this, let me just read a little bit, this is right after where Nancy just read, Like most fanatics, Rodin could blind himself to facts with sheer belief. The escalating costs of the war, the tottering economy of France under the burden of a war becoming increasingly unwinnable, the demoralization of the conscripts were a bagatelle, a non-entity, a nothing. De Gaulle understood all that. He understood that the drain that Algeria was having on France and realized that he needed to get out of Algeria for very, very practical things. It's actually one of his great strokes of brilliance in many ways in solidifying the Fifth Republic. So it was a very, very fraught time.
Peter Starr, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at American University. He's professor of literature. He's the author of a web-based multimedia book, We the Paranoid. Short break, right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by America's Natural Gas Alliance, whose members are participating in an online registry providing drilling information to the public, fracfocus.org. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Michael Fassbender. In the past year, he starred in four films, playing a sex addict in Shame, Carl Jung in A Dangerous Method, Mr. Rochester in Jane Eyre, and a mutant villain in X-Men First Class. His other films include Inglourious Basterds, Fish Tank, and Hunger. Join us.
And we're back. We'll go right back to the phones to Rye, New Hampshire. Hi there, Connie. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Surely.
This is such an interesting discussion. I read The Day of the Jackal many years ago, and if I had known that it was going to be discussed today, I probably would have dug it out and read it again. But I remember being struck, low those many years ago, by the level of surveillance the Sûreté was able to maintain over all of France. Who checked into what hotel on what day? That I can remember that being part of their investigation. Is that historically accurate? And if it is, who instituted that type of surveillance in what was supposedly a democratic republic?
John Weissman.
Well, the Sûreté, the currently called, I guess, the DST, the Director of
Security, of
Surveillance of the Territory, is how it translates, is a very powerful internal security apparatus. And while the French don't have the hundreds of thousands of closed-circuit video cameras that the English have, they maintain the ability to tap any phone in Paris and some of the outstanding areas within seconds
Really?
One of the things that...
Well, if they have it, surely we do, too.
Well, actually, no, because their courts are a lot different than our courts. And by the way, the DST sent in the 60s, in 1963, I believe, a group over here to look at our presidential protection versus de Gaulle's. And they came away saying that the Secret Service were a bunch of clowns, basically. That the American president was not protected half so well as the French president was. Now, the French president went through, what, 10 assassination attempts?
30.
Yeah.
30 assassination 30. Attempts. Whereas there was one very successful one in 1963. So DST is a very effective organization, and I gather now that they're not using motorcycle riders to pick up the tickets. I think everything is computerized these days.
But, you know, it's interesting that the Jackal would have succeeded had, at least in the novel, had de Gaulle not bent forward to kiss
Absolutely.
A metal receiver.
It's something interesting that, of course, the Jackal is English and forgets that piece of French habit.
Yes, that's a good point.
He did not factor that in.
I hope that answers your question, Connie. To Bright, Indiana. Good morning, David.
Good morning. I love this topic, love the novel. I first saw the film before I read the novel back in the 70s and then saw the new film more recently, and I wondered about your panel's comment about the making of the film related to this.
I saw the 1973 film, which I found most intriguing.
I think so, too. And Forsythe gets credit for the screenplay on that movie. And one of the things I noticed, having read this and then I screened the film right after, is that he has a couple of hiccups in the novel that he cleans up and makes a lot more effective in the film.
Such as?
Such as the murder of the Baroness. In the book, he has her overhearing a conversation. And that's a cliche. And in the movie, she rolls over and says, "You can tell me anything." And he just simply puts the pillow over her face and smothers her.
Right.
The second thing that he does in the book is he has, as the Norwegian priest, check into a cheap hotel on the left bank, the Jackal does. And LaBelle is looking out his window, which faces the Grand Quai d'Augustin's, and the hotel where the Jackal is on the Grand Quai d'Augustin's, and they are basically looking at each other, not knowing that one is looking at the other. That also is a cliche. And he changes that to an apartment on the right bank and uses, by the way, not a gay bar, but a steam bath.
Ah. The second film was with Bruce Willis. I gather that was not as effective. Did you see it, Nancy?
Well, I want to make a case for not watching the movies because I contemplated watching both of the movies in anticipation of this. But I thought, you know, part of the magic of the book is the weaving of details. And I think what it does is take the reader along and allows you to use all those details to paint a picture in your own head. And I thought that was sort of part of the magic of the book. So I was almost afraid to watch the movies because I'd painted it in my own head, you know, and I think that was part of it. That's part of the way that you're taken along in the story where you already know the outcome.
I think you should actually watch the first movie burn the second movie.
Yeah. Peter, we haven't talked about Kowalski because he becomes a central figure in why the group that planned the assassination fears they might have to call it off. And the whole issue of torture comes into it.
Yes.
Talk about Kowalski.
Yes. Well, Kowalski was guarding the three OAS leaders in Italy and was the man who did the mail drops with handcuffs, the briefcase handcuffed to his wrist. And he is lured back into France by virtue of a story about a stepdaughter, I believe it was, who is suddenly taken ill. And it's a very moving piece of work that is, I think it doesn't come through, it doesn't get played out in the movie. I think for reasons of simple filmic economy, you can't do that level of a subplot in a movie in a way you can do it in a novel. And I don't regret that being gone from the film. And of course, then you, if you were to do that, you would have to show this absolutely brutal torture of Kowalski that led to the revelations of certain kinds of aspects to the plot.
Well, of course, the French were known for that.
Absolutely.
If anyone's seen the Battle of Algiers, I mean, this was par for the course. The French did not give Miranda warnings, and still don't. And Kowalski's treatment was no better or worse than was given to Algerian nationalists.
I think for a reader, the book goes from being an interesting plot, an interesting dissection of people's motives, into a real ugly crime novel and all the brutality that comes with this kind of plot. I thought for me as a reader, that was the turning point. I was no longer as intrigued by motives. That was the first point I thought, you know, this is ugly. This is going to be ugly.
Yeah.
And to Chris in Fairfax, Virginia, good morning to you.
Hi. It's a fascinating conversation. I'd like to comment on just one regarding disclosure of information. I was in the Marines, and part of what I did was counterterrorism. And after my honorable discharge, I went to school to study journalism, and I became a journalist. And I still find myself cringing. And leaning far more to the side of keep it quiet rather than disclose, because the bad guys can read the news, and I'm sure they learn a lot, and I can't stop thinking, you know, you have to know your enemy. So you have to be able to think a bit like them in order to close with and destroy them. But I thought I'd comment on how I struggle with that, too, and wondering what journalists struggle with as well in that regard, with knowing they might help.
John.
Well, I think in fiction gives you deniability that nonfiction does not. I have problems with some of the stuff I read journalistically these days in terms of how much it discloses, perhaps inadvertently. But there is still a lot of stuff disclosed in terms of sources and methods that I can easily do in fiction because it is fiction. I think that sometimes because of deadline pressures and because of competition, people tend to do more than good sense might suggest, especially when we're in a time when, indeed, as the caller said, the bad guys can read just about as much. I mean, when I wrote KBL, Killed Bin Laden, everything I wrote in that is open sourced. I did some interviews. I talked to a lot of people. But it is open sourced. I use no classified material in that book. And yet, people have come to me, people who are well positioned to know, and said, how did you find that out?
Nancy.
You know, I think it's interesting you raise Bin Laden because, and let me begin, by the way, Chris, just thank you for your service and welcome to the business.
I should say.
It's interesting you bring up the Bin Laden case because I can tell you as a journalist, I think there's been an erosion of that trust in terms of how information was used. In the case of Bin Laden, the administration declassified things that would have never been classified, and one could argue that they did it for the political gain of saying that they had captured Bin Laden. And I think that's why it's become such a difficult thing in terms of determining what information is releasable and what's not, because I think both sides are using information as a tool. And I thought the Bin Laden example was a really exceptional case of that, because things that would have never been declassified before were in a matter of 24 hours after his death.
Here's an email from Jonathan, who says, this is the first book I remember my mother reading. She said she enjoyed it, but the topic was difficult for her. It marked a changing, more violent world. Listeners should consider that this book came out just after a slew of assassinations, including John and Bobby Kennedy, the Reverend Martin Luther King, number of political figures in South America. It also was around the time of the rise of terrorist groups like the Symbionese Liberation Army and the Red Brigade. Interesting to remember all that. All right, let's go to John in Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, you're on the air. John, are you there?
Oh, yes. Hi, Diane.
Hi there.
I want to carry this part of the conversation. I'm glad it went in this direction just a little bit. When I initially called, it was right after your guest essentially admitted to self-censorship in writing his fiction under the, I guess, small d direction of individuals with high-level classified clearances. And I cringed at the thought of novelists and people in literature essentially taking their marching orders, and maybe that's a little strong, from government agents. I can't imagine what would have happened if Mark Twain had consulted with the government about writing a book about a white boy and a black slave going down the river on a raft. I can't.
All right, let's get an answer from John Weissman, but you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show.
Well, novelists and journalists don't get their marching orders from anybody. What it is nice to have is someone who will back you and say, yes, this is how we do it. This is how the language goes. This is the capability of the weapon. This is how it works. When I say I've got a brain trust, I do have a brain trust, because you can't write this kind of fiction without interviewing, researching, and talking to people. But what you don't want to do is give people who have very bad motives an insight in a way that they can use it against you. At least I don't. And if you want to call that self-censorship, fine. I don't consider it that. I consider it prudence.
All right. And to Ahmed in Cleveland, Ohio, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Diane. Charles de Gaulle has a famous expression. It says we have lost a battle, but not the war. I'd like to ask Nancy Youssef, what does this mean?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to let Peter take that, because
no,
that's
not
something. No? What does it mean, we've lost the battle, but not the war? Well, in the case of France, I think there would be a case to be made that maybe Algeria didn't come out in the way that they wanted, as Peter talked about earlier, about the loss of its sort of imperial status, but it retained its French dignity, if you will, its power, its France-ness, if you will. And I that was my take on it. But
tell me, each of you, to whom you might recommend this book, what age group, sensibility, etc.
Diane, as you mentioned earlier, I work on this project on paranoia. And paranoid novels and paranoid stories tend to portray the world as a Manichaean us versus them struggle. And the thing that I very much respect about Frederick Forsyth's novels, and by the way, also John Weissman's KBL, is that it is very much a human struggle. There's no big government behind this struggle. It's La Belle against the Jackal in a very human scale. And I think that's very salutary. I think I miss that kind of humanistic sense of an action thriller, action thrillers that have a kind of humanistic sense to it.
Nancy?
I'd recommend it to journalists, to people who love writing, to people who are curious about the relationship between police and government and politicians.
What age?
I would recommend it to young readers. I think it's so simply and beautifully written that I think it's something young readers should read to get a sense of what beautiful writing is, the simplicity of a sentence, and how those simple sentences crafted together can make something really beautiful.
John Weissman.
I agree with my colleagues here, and also I would add it to actually the United States Marine Reading Program. Hmm. I think it would be great for our young men and women in uniform.
John Weissman His most recent novel is Kill Bin Laden. Nancy Youssef is Pentagon correspondent for McClatchy Newspapers. Peter Starr is Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at American University. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And let me tell you that our next reader's review is going to go in an entirely different direction. On Wednesday, February 22nd, we will review Ethan Frome by Edith Wharton. I hope you'll read it right along with us. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your day.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from